everyone, and welcome to the second episode of Solace in the City. Today, I am so excited to be interviewing comedian and podcaster himself, Francis Ellis.
Thanks for having me, Zoe. This is fun.
I'm so excited. And if you notice the sound quality is a little better, it's because I'm recording in a better studio than my apartment. Anyway, I thought I'd just kind of touch on some background information first, if you don't mind introducing yourself. Where are you from? Where'd you go to school? What'd you study?
Sure. So my name's Francis. I grew up in Maine. I went to Harvard and studied political science and English while I was there.
What was it like at Harvard?
Harvard was fun. I liked it, you know? It's funny. It's like when I say that, people always have a joke.
I don't have a joke. I'm not funny.
Meaning like, oh, they're like, where'd you go to school? And you say Harvard. And then they want to fuck with you. Can we swear on this podcast?
I'm sorry.
Okay. They're either like, oh, look, at, you know, like, look, they just think you're an asshole for saying that. And I know it's
or
even.
Or they think you're joking?
Yeah. Maybe they think I'm fucking with them or they'll be like, because it's such a cliche. Only the douchebag in movies ever says that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I guess it's like hard to not. I mean, there's no other answer than actually saying where you went to school.
But. Well, that's right. But nobody says that when you say Stanford or Yale. Harvard is a douchebag answer.
It's like,
douchebag
it's like answer. A cliche. But
it's like people. People think you're being a dick when you say that.
Well.
But what's the alternative? Just lie? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess. There's right. No real one. And you played sports there, correct?
Yeah, that's what I ended up doing. I just deflect and say, well, I played lacrosse there, which helped me get in.
And I'm sure that helps your cause.
I don't know about that. Exactly. That's another douchebag answer.
It's okay. Well, you studied political science and English?
Yeah, literature, cool. Yeah.
So, but as overall, you like your experience at Harvard?
I had a great time there. I loved it. I learned how to write there. And, you know, a lot of people say like, well, my God, you're a comedian and your parents, and you went to Harvard, your parents must be disappointed or something. But I would argue that more than a lot of my friends, I'm actually using a lot of the things that I learned in college now in my life.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, definitely having that background in English and being well-read, I'm sure, and just being able to speak is kind of...
Yeah, speak it, and write, too. I mean, yeah. You know, I was a blogger at Barstool for a couple of years, and I think everything I learned about writing was stuff that I'd learned in college.
Did you do comedy in college?
A little bit. My senior year, I started doing it. I got into... stand up. I did two shows my senior year. There was a comedy club in Cambridge called the Comedy Connection, or maybe it was the Comedy Studio. And it was above a Chinese food restaurant. And I would always walk by it. And when I got the urge to perform, I finally walked in there one day and asked if I could. And they gave me a spot a couple weeks later.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And then did you come to New York directly after school?
Yeah. So I'd applied for Teach for America.
Oh.
And I was kind of excited about that idea, and I thought I was going to get it. But I had applied in the last round, mm-hmm. And right as they were checking over our applications, they ran out of funding for that year, and they had all these cutbacks. So they had kind of offered me a job, and then they took it away.
No way.
And when that happened, that was late too. That was April. You know, a month before graduation. And that's when I said, all right, well, I'm just going to move to New York and become a comedian. See if that I can make that work.
That's awesome. So did you start working directly for Barstool then or?
Oh, no. No, I moved to New York and this was in 2011. And I got into the improv scene at the Upright Citizens Brigade, UCB.
Oh, yeah. Okay, roommate's boyfriend performs there.
Yeah, it's a great place if that's where, you know, if you're trying to learn improv. I actually really liked the sketch writing classes there, too, that I took. I think I found those more useful even for me than the improv classes. But I worked there. Sorry, I took classes there while I was also doing stand-up, and then I started tutoring. I got a job tutoring, and that was like what I ended up doing to supplement my income while I was being a comedian. And I did that for about 5 or 6 years maybe before I finally got hired at Barstool. Got hired at Barstool at the end of 2016.
Okay. And you mentioned your parents, or like the joke that your friends say about your parents not wanting you to go into comedy, but is that really how they felt, or did they also see that connection between English and comedy?
Well, my parents were totally supportive.
That's awesome.
Regardless of what I wanted to do. I think they knew that I was going to be realistic about it. They didn't see me as some delusional wanderer who was shipping off to Los Angeles to find myself as an actor. You know, I had a pretty specific thought, and the fact that I was able to, you know, pay my rent while I was pursuing it, that's all they cared about.
Yeah, and they knew you wanted to initially do Teach for America, so I guess that makes sense. So I wanted to kind of, I obviously know you have places to be, and so I kind of wanted to jump right into, not that I don't think your life's exciting, but I wanted to jump into kind of some questions that touch on like the theme of my podcast,
I guess. Course, yeah.
But just for some background, when I was brainstorming questions to ask, I kind of got stuck because I knew about you being fired from Barstool, and I knew about your podcast, but I kind of had heard about that on other podcasts, and I didn't really want to beat a dead horse.
Mm-hmm.
So I was then looking through our mutual followers and noticed it was very male. The entire Hopkins lacrosse team was following you. And I saw my friend Adrian was one of your followers. So I called him and I said, listen, I'm talking to Francis about for my podcast, and I was stuck on ideas. You know, what could we come up with? And he gave me some great insight. And he said, you know, Francis is kind of looked at as, he's my idol. He's awesome. I mean, and it makes sense. Like, you're a good looking guy. You had a phenomenal education. You were a D1 athlete. You're obviously very funny. You worked at Barstool. Like, you're kind of the ultimate bro. So, I mean, you kind of are. And I think people, especially young guys, like 20 something year olds, will consider you or your life to be pretty ideal. So I kind of wanted to ask you about your life when you were working for Barstool. And prior to being fired, like, was your life really this picture perfect?
Oh, God, no, not at all. And, you know, I hate to burst Adrian's bubble, but, you know, I've had, unfortunately, always been afflicted with what has now almost become a self-fulfilling prophecy for comedians, which is, you know, the really persistent self-doubt, you know, certain real bouts of depression, and self-loathing, all that stuff. And you know, I've been a little bit open about it. I was a little bit open about it at Barstool. I kind of had a moment there where I was really struggling for a long period of time with my thoughts, and it all came tumbling out of me in a blog that I wrote one day, where it was me thinking out loud in a blog about suicide. And I wrote this long thing, which was meant to be a way to show people how I deal with suicidal thoughts. And of course, Barstool is meant to be a lighthearted diversion,
yeah,
funny humor sports blog for people. And so I put it up, I hit publish for about 10 minutes. And then I had this feeling of like, God, this is way too personal and too dark. This is not what people come here for. So I took it down. But what I've learned, because this is what also led to me being fired, is that any blog you put up for even a second is going to be immortalized, or you know, screenshot and then made available. The internet is written in ink, so it's still going to be able to be found. And so a bunch of people found it, and it was me revealing to a lot of people that, you know, on a daily basis I have suicidal thoughts, and that I had I gave like four or five ways that I try to keep them at bay, which include, you know, making sure that I exercise a lot, getting outside, you know, taking joy in the success of other people around me. Because if you pin your emotional ups and downs on your own life, you're putting so much pressure on yourself, and the outcomes become far more heavy and affect you more. Whereas like to see a person around me at Barstool, having a great blog or having a great show or whatever, and to genuinely feel and get excited by it for them, means that you're getting these boosts, and you don't have to work for them that hard. It's just a matter of being excited and empathetic. But I wrote this blog, and you know, within that day, I must have received 400 emails, maybe 700 DMs from people who were so moved by it, but more importantly, who couldn't believe that I was going through this thing that sounded so similar to what they were going through. Wow. And to have shown these people from all over the country, all different types of people, that they're not alone, you know, in their darkness or their tough moments, made me very grateful that I had actually published the blog. And it's to this day the thing that I'm happiest about having done at Barstool.
Wow. I had no idea. I actually hadn't seen that article, surprisingly, but I mean, that kind of answers a lot of my questions. Just out of curiosity, were the responses and DMs you received like mostly from men?
Well, yeah, I think they were probably, absolutely. You know, my Instagram following at the time was like 15% female, 85% male. And so, yeah, I think definitely so. I mean, I was getting messages from doctors who were fans. Wow. Who would help, you know, offer to talk. Everyone wanted to said, you know, if you ever want to talk, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. Some people offering their support. Some people saying, you know, I got a message from a guy who had said that the day before he read my article, he drove his car to the middle of the George Washington Bridge, got out, and stood over the railing with the intention to jump. He had written his goodbye notes to his girlfriend, to his parents, and all this, and he stood there for a long time, and something made him get back into his car. But he, you know, went to bed, didn't feel great, wasn't feeling good at all, woke up, read my blog, and said that he thought my blog was the thing that had spoken directly to him, that had sort of pulled him back from the ledge, so to speak. And I'm not trying to take credit for that.
No, I mean,
but even if one person is that affected by something that I've written, you have to say that it's worth it.
Oh, 1,000%. I mean, that's just what I want to do with this podcast. Yeah. Is show people that, and have people on so they can share stories like that and just take solace in it and be like, oh, okay, I'm not the only person feeling like this. I'm not, you know, the only one suffering. I mean, I had no idea about that story, and I still asked you to be on this podcast.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. How did the people from Barstool respond? Did they want you to put it back up?
You know, I think everyone knew it was something that was deeply personal to me. So a lot of people at the company, you know, wanted to make sure that I was okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that it was the first time I had made allusions to having dark thoughts.
Okay.
So I think people had always wondered, been aware that there was something bubbling under the surface. A couple guys pulled me aside into quiet rooms and sat down and talked with me for a while. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just another case of like, you'd just be shocked at how common such an extreme thought is. And the way that people have dealt with it and, you know, how they get through it. Everyone's different, right?
Yeah.
So, you'd have to say though, that anyone who has attempted suicide or really even gone to such lengths as to think about it that much, you know, they've survived themselves in a way. Because nobody wants to be this way. Nobody fucking... I think that's the biggest misconception about depression and mental illness is that people who don't have it assume that it is a kind of an indulgence.
Yeah.
And trust me, you know, I am not wallowing. I'm doing everything I fucking can to make my brain as... you know, steady and normal as possible. I have from my diet to my exercise routine to my extremely expensive therapy sessions, you know, all that shit is part and parcel of keeping this machine running despite the fact that there is a severe design flaw.
Yeah.
In who I am. So, there's a great special right now on HBO, Gary Gulman's special. It's called The Great Depression. And he's one of the best comedians, in my opinion, in the world. And roundly known among comedians in New York as being one of the greatest joke writers there is. And it's an entire hour about how, over the last 2 years, he had such a severe bout of depression. And he's been dealing with it his whole life, but that he hospitalized himself. And it's all about his recovery from that. And he somehow finds a way to make it this bubbly, lighthearted, wonderful, you know, pontification on depression. And he truly frames it as a disease and not some, you know, woe is me, feel bad for me. Because that's not...
It is a disease. Yeah. I mean, it's like breaking your ankle. I mean, it's... physical and mental, and it's terrible.
Right.
So I'm just kind of curious. I mean, I know that you wrote the article as kind of a way to through which you could kind of process everything. Did you usually write to process your thoughts?
Yeah. For what I learned about a year in at Barstool was that the more personal that I got with my writing, the more that it connected with readers. And that's when I stopped kind of writing like, oh, look, you know, here's a video clip of a late night fight at a Denny's, and here are my thoughts on it. I stopped writing that stuff, and I started writing, you know, 1,000-word imagination pieces about, you know, the girl that works at this local cupcake shop and whether or not we're actually in love, you know, or... all, you know, all kinds of just totally ridiculous, long form, anxiety riddled, over analytical, many paragraph pieces about a very small exchange. And I was so open and so transparent, but I would exaggerate a lot. I mean, I would really speak a stream of consciousness that should never have been on page. And then occasionally you kind of forget what should remain personal and maybe quiet to you. And you open yourself up a little too much. And that was always something I struggled with because I never really knew where the line was. Like, you know, should I be talking about members of my family? What should I remain private with?
And was this just your written comedy or was this also in stand-up?
Yeah, I think I'm always, at this point, I'm pretty open in every avenue that I'm involved in. So in stand-up, though, you have to be funny every 30 seconds.
Yeah, that's true.
And so you don't really have the luxury of going on for a full paragraph without a laugh. Whereas... in a written piece, you know,
don't really know what their direct response is. Yeah,
exactly. So I would say I do it a little bit less in stand up, you know.
Yeah, because I mean, obviously you touched on it earlier, but there's a very strong connection between mental health and comedy, and you see a lot of different comedians kind of use, it almost seems like they're using comedy or stand up as their form of therapy. I mean, like Pete Davidson, for example, like openly talks about his depression, and it's, but then he's kind of labeled almost as like this self-deprecating comedian, like that's, you know, maybe what his comedy style would be. Do you think that the fact that, I don't know, I guess I'd like to hear your thoughts kind of on whether that's healthy or like, or hurting or like, or negative that people use mental health in comedy so much or rely on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't think that a stand-up stage and a microphone are an adequate substitute for therapy,
yeah,
or medication. And I fear that a lot of comedians actually believe that. They think that by going to an open mic on a Wednesday in the Lower East Side and getting up there and speaking their truth for 5 minutes about how miserable they are, that somehow they are being proactive about you know, their brain chemistry. And that's ridiculous, because you're not getting answers. You're not, you know, you're not taking true steps forward to fixing yourself. You're just dumping. And one thing that, you know, mental health issues and depression are, it's so pervasive in stand-up comedy that it's almost a joke itself.
Yeah.
And sometimes you kind of wonder, you know, is a comedian on stage talking about being depressed just because they've seen all the great comedians do it and they think this is the language we speak? Or are they truly suffering? And usually you can kind of hear it in the way that they talk. And what they're talking about. But what happens, the big difference is, right, that the great comedians that talk about their depression, that's the Gary Gulman guy, they will still write jokes and really great jokes about what it's like to go through this. And Gary Gulman, for example, one thing he talks about is how he knew he was in trouble when he started eating ice cream with a fork, right? Like if you find fork tine marks in an ice cream container, that means that that person is too depressed to use a spoon and a bowl like a normal functioning person. Yeah. And I think that's great, right?
Yeah.
And that's like actually trying to find the silver lining and the light in this dark thing. But if you're just getting up there and kind of wallowing in your despair and trying to elicit sympathy laughs from the audience, I think you're doing a disservice not only to yourself, but also to mental illness, because you're just saturating everybody with it and then everyone stops believing it.
Yeah, I think also, I mean, I think in some ways it almost then is either used as a crutch kind of or a card to pull out. And also, I don't know. I mean, I do see the importance of bringing it up, but where was I going with that? I think sometimes like the whole point about mental illness is that doesn't necessarily, you know, it's not blatant and in your face. Like you could come off like you are as like a very personable person and very happy and all of that and still suffer. So it doesn't have like a face and it doesn't have an act. It's pervasive regardless of what you're talking about, kind of. And just like how you said, with this comedian who talked about ice cream and kind of incorporated jokes, that's the whole point, is like he
right.
is still high functioning, still a happy person or comes off as that, but you know, also has these awful thoughts. So I think that's, I mean, even just the fact of like kind of how you opened up about your article shows I mean, I had no idea. I was just going to ask if you ever made jokes about anxiety in the past, like little right. did I know, you know?
Yeah. No, I, yeah, it's so, you know, your original question was, is it bad? Well, let's say like, should comedians be using it as a crutch? And I don't think so. I don't think that's good at all. Of yeah. course. I think it's like any subject, it, you know, it when presented right, can make for amazing humor. But if it's just mentioned as some kind of, for the sake of mentioning it, you know, that's bullshit.
Yeah. I actually read this article recently that was talking about how there's now exists a culture where 20-something-year-old guys kind of who aren't in comedy, but they use comedy maybe in like daily life as their means to therapy. And I think that can probably be traced back to what they, you know, what they watch on Comedy Central and things like that, or what they see from comedians, because they're like, oh, this is a way I can joke about it and just kind of brush it off rather than actually dealing with their issues. So I was wondering, I mean, you mentioned that you go to therapy, but for someone who, a guy who either can't afford it, or like, what resources are offered to either comedians or just in general, if any, to deal with their anxiety or depression, et cetera?
I guess this goes to almost sort of the blog that I wrote, which is, you know, what I can only offer what has helped me. Mm-hmm. And if you can't afford therapy, you know, that's sad. But I know that there are help centers, and even, you know, if you have health insurance, you can get in-network therapists who are very, very good. But what I would say, if that's not an option, is, you know, exercise for me is so valuable.
Yeah.
I really make a point every day to get exercise in some ways, you know, whether if I'm lifting weights or running on a treadmill or even just getting out and, you know, jumping rope or something like that. It doesn't need to be on a full on workout, but get your heart rate moving and get your blood moving. And it just adds oxygen to the brain. And for me, that has been an immensely important tool in helping me sleep well. So that's like the first thing. Mm-hmm. Sleep is yeah. so important. You know, you hear a lot of very depressed people say like, I just never want to get out of bed. I just want to stay in bed. And the key to getting out of bed in the morning is not going to bed at 1 a.m.
Yeah.
You know, try to have your light off before 11:30. And the key to that is not bringing your fucking phone into your bed. Okay. I set up my phone charger out in the hallway from my bedroom.
That's smart.
And I will plug my phone in and I will set my alarm, and then I will walk into my bedroom and it's in a different place. And I will read my book before bed. Maybe 5 pages. I don't know. I don't want to sound like a hermit, but your phone screen should not be the last thing that you see before you go to bed.
Yeah.
You know,
I'd be better about that.
Wipe it from your brain, and then your phone alarm will go off in the morning and you'll be forced to get out of bed and you will go turn your alarm off. And what you should not do is then pull your phone out of the plug and go back into bed with it. Keep your bed and your phone separate. I can't tell you how important that is.
Yeah, that's true. I should definitely be better about that. I guess kind of the last thing I was wondering about in regarding mental health and kind of how men deal with it is, I think that there's like a tendency or an unwillingness for young men to share their feelings. And I think that, I mean, obviously your whole job is to share your feelings, whether they be about mental health or about your day, whatnot. So I guess kind of what advice would you give to, or how would you encourage young men maybe in their 20s who are, you know, think that by showing weakness or showing that they're not happy, how would you encourage them to open up?
Well, I think mental health like a lot of issues, has really taken amazing leaps forward in its acceptance in popular culture. If you were to compare it to, you know, America's thinking on like gay rights, you go back to the 50s and 60s, and gay people were seen as an aberration. There were no gay pride parades. It was this people couldn't fathom it. It was detrimental to the nuclear family, all that shit. And then, mm-hmm. you know, within 30 years, and especially within the last 15, the country has swung over to everyone's in favor of gay marriage. Yeah, of course. Like, what are you talking about? You're seen as being a crotchety, out of touch idiot if you oppose it. So that's a good parallel, I think. You know, I think with so many celebrities and comedians, some athletes have opened up about their struggles with mental health. A fascinating one for me is Ron Artest. I watched his, he was an NBA player, famously played for he played for the Lakers with Kobe for years. But before that, he was playing for the Indiana Pacers for the famous Malice at the Palace, which was like, it's like the worst brawl that has ever happened in the NBA, where he went into the crowd and started attacking fans. And it was only found out later, I think, that he had severe bipolar disorder.
Oh, wow.
And now he has become a spokesperson for mental health awareness and is, you know, a very decorated face in that community. And is, but here was this tough kid from the streets, you know, who came up as an NBA player, and nobody was talking about that. But had he been more open about it, you know, you can't help but wonder, might the team or the organization have helped him get the help he needed to avoid this sort of thing that happened?
When did he play? Like, when was that?
He probably retired in maybe like 2013 or 14 or something.
Okay.
But he was playing all through the 2000s. And
yeah, but even back then, I mean, yeah, you're right, just in terms of progress.
Yeah.
I saw a meme recently that was something like, I can't like recreate it, but it was something comparing kind of how baby boomers talk about mental health versus like millennials and Gen Z, whatever
right.
next, but just the like harsh contrast of us being more open, which I think is just so imperative.
Yeah. But as far to your question, because I feel like I keep getting sidetracked, I'm hoping that a 20-year-old man in college, in a frat, you know, now or maybe a couple years from now, won't be worried about going to his friends and saying, dudes, you know, I need help. I'm not happy. I'm really unhappy. I'm really miserable. I'm having a lot of dark thoughts. And that not those guys will know where to point him. Mm-hmm. You know, even if they don't feel comfortable kind of helping him out on their own, they'll know enough to say like, dude, you have to go to the Office of Health Services or the place on campus, and you need to talk to somebody because there are people here that are set up to help you. You got to do it today.
Yeah.
Fucking go. Hopefully that, you know, that becomes a normal thing, like telling somebody, hey man, like I cut my finger. Where do I go? Or, yeah, you know, exactly. That sort of thing.
Do you think that, you worked at Barstool, which is controversial, I guess, like the company and kind of more so, I'd say less the company and more so just kind of its audience. Do you think that in any way, or did you ever find that you kind of had felt that it was promoting a culture of like toxic masculinity that would in some ways kind of prohibit that?
That's a good question. I didn't feel when I was there that that the work that people that everyone was putting out was encouraging men to revert to yesterday's thinking. I did not feel that Dave or anyone there was sort of like galvanizing men to mistreat women or to dive deeper into the toxic masculinity thing. I really did not feel that way. I think unfortunately what happened was culture became so much more sensitive to it. And rightly so. I think the outside world really moved forward in saying like, it is no longer okay to talk to women this way in the workplace. It is no longer okay to do this. The Me Too movement exploded while I was at Barstool.
Yeah.
So, you know, with that, unfortunately, came a lot of, you know, a lot of people started pointing to Barstool for stuff that they had said in their 15-year history, which, 15 years ago, I mean, if they had said some of those things that they'd said 15 years ago today or 10 years ago, you know, you'd be like, whoa, what are you doing? Like, you got to know that that's going to cause some problems. But while I was there, you know, from 2016 to 2019, it had already undergone a major overhaul, a major, you know, a major effort to become more gender balanced in terms of its content contributors, in hiring Erica Nardini as a CEO. And, you know, Dave was the first guy to tell me, like, when I wrote, you know, whenever I wrote something that was controversial, like, yo, you got to be careful. Like, don't do that. That's not who we are. You know, the ultimate irony was that I ended up getting fired and effectively taken down by an article that was portrayed as being somehow anti-women. Although most people didn't really say that. I don't think anyone really saw that because, frankly, if it had been a man, I would have written the same exact thing.
Yeah.
It was just grossly insensitive to a very, you know, very touchy subject, and with a terrible outcome. So, you know, who knows? I don't think anyone would have said that any of my work leading up to that point though was misogynistic. And I don't think much of the work that I saw there was particularly so.
I'm going to ask you now 5 questions, to end this episode, just so we can kind of, I guess like dive deep for the last couple of minutes.
Sure.
So the first question, what's one thing in your life that's happened to you that's made you a stronger person today?
I would say definitely getting broken up with by a person that I was deeply in love with. A girl that I dated for 7 years, thought we would end up together. And that ended and it sent me into a pretty dark place. But then you kind of, each day you get a little better and you find happiness again. And then you realize, okay, well, I got through that. That didn't kill me. So that'll make you stronger. Getting dumped.
I guess, in what point of your life that was that? Like,
that was the end? Yeah, that was in, I guess, 2016, right before Barstool. Like 8 months before Barstool, yeah.
Got it. Second question is, do you believe everything happens for a reason?
No, I like to think that I have some control over my own choices and that not everything is inevitable. But I also know that when bad things happen, a good way to bounce back from them and to find the positives in it is to say like, okay, you know, that happened for a reason and how can I grow and learn from it and prevent it from happening again? So it's weird. It's like when things are going well, I like to think I made that happen. And then when things are going badly, I'm like, God is fucking me, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Or like just finding the silver lining and everything and making it something good. Because right. I guess you could look at everything as being something good or at least like a learning or a lesson.
Right.
The crystal ball could tell you anything about yourself, your life, the future, or anything else. What would you most want to know?
I'd love to know if I will be performing stand-up in 10 or 15 years. You know, is that something that I'm still going to be really passionate about? will I be much more successful in that in 10 or 15 years, or will I be doing something adjacent to stand up, you know, like writing for a TV show or acting or whatever it may be. That's something that I'd be interested to see.
Do you kind of have an answer that you'd want to know, like you'd want it to be?
Well, I'd be blown away if I looked into a crystal ball and 15 years from now I'm headlining Madison Square Garden, you know? That would
Yeah.
be pretty nuts. But even if it were like theaters, that would be cool. Or I guess sold out clubs, if all my club shows were sold out. But I'm not that far off. Like I'm sold out clubs now.
Yeah.
So I guess I just want to know that things were a little bit better than they are right now, you know?
Yeah, got it. Okay, what, if anything, is too serious to be joked about? Coming from a comedian.
Yeah, I think most comedians will tell you that there's nothing that's off limits as long as it's funny. The problem is that certain topics is just way harder to be funny about. You know, it's so much harder to write an actually funny rape joke that most people can at least acknowledge is funny. And it's even harder still if you're a man trying to do it. And I'm not saying like, oh, men should be able to. It's not what I'm saying. I'm saying a woman who has more experience with that, like whatever's personal to you, it's easier for the audience to connect with stuff.
Yeah.
So like, you know, if I shouldn't write, I'm not writing jokes about police brutality because I'm not really affected by that. Whereas like a black person or, you know, a person of color who has endured that's going to be much more personal to them,
Yeah, because
you
you have to
know?
write things, I guess, that you have experience with.
I think it's easier for an audience to buy it from you. Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be pretty hard to buy that
Yeah.
from you. What do you love most about yourself?
I like that I
Love.
wasn't. What's that?
Love,
I
not
love
like.
that I was not afraid to take a shot on something that was so uncertain as comedy. You know, that I've never shied away from going off the beaten path and not doing the safe thing. That in college I didn't follow the wave that all my friends were on of going into finance or having really pretty secure livelihoods and becoming very financially successful, and that I just struck out on this idea of being a comedian in New York. And, you know, I think 7 years later I was headlining the Wilbur Theater, shooting my special in front of 1600 people, and that was a major validation for me that I had made a decision that wasn't insane, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a really good thing to be proud of, and just like you love your courage.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay, last question. In one sentence, how do you find solace in the city?
Cook for yourself. I like to cook my own meals. I find it very therapeutic, and the focus of cooking and then eating, even if you're in a shitty, tiny shoebox apartment, or if you're on a farm out in Vermont, you know, the taste of cooking your own food is makes you feel like you're at home, and that's peaceful.
Yeah, I never really thought about that. What do you cook?
I cook very simple food. I'm by no means a chef de cuisine, but you know, I like to cook fish and sort of more of like a Mediterranean diet type thing.
Like that.
Yeah.
Francis, thank you so much for agreeing to let me interview. I really can't tell you how much I appreciate this and just will really treasure this moment for the rest of my
Oh, please. It's
life.
my I'm very happy to do it. It's really fun.
Thank you. And so where can my very large audience of followers follow you, and what shows do you have coming up that they could go to?
Yeah. Come check out my shows at Gotham Comedy Club, November 22nd and 23rd. It's a great comedy club. It's right on 23rd Street between 7th and 8th. You can get tickets for that at francisellis.com. Otherwise, follow me on Instagram at Francis CC Ellis.
Awesome. Well, thanks again,
Yeah.
and yeah, I'll see you guys later.
Sweet.